Hello, it's 1 o'clock GMT. I'm Ed Butler, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Today, the US broadcast media is wall-to-wall Cohen as the president's former lawyer delivers several hours of testimony to Congress, as well as calling his former boss a liar, a cheat, and a con man. Michael Cohen said he had evidence the president had personally committed electoral finance fraud, paying off two former mistresses.
I am providing a copy of a $35,000 check that President Trump personally signed to reimburse me for the illegal hush money I paid on his behalf.
Meanwhile, President Trump himself is elsewhere today saying nice things about North Korea's Kim Jong-un. The two leaders are beginning a summit aimed at reducing nuclear tensions. That and more in Business Matters after the latest world news.
Hello, I'm Julie Candler with the BBC News. Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, has said he fears there won't be a peaceful transfer of power if the president loses the 2020 election. Mr. Cohen, who is about to begin a 3-year jail term, made a series of allegations to a congressional committee, including that Mr. Trump knew in advance during the 2016 election that WikiLeaks was going to release hacked emails damaging the Democrats. The Democrat chairman of the committee, Elijah Cummings, said he believed Mr. Cohen's testimony.
I think he's remorseful. And a lot of people said, oh, the reason why he's coming in is because he just wants to get his sentence reduced. I think that's not likely. But the fact is, I don't want you to miss this. And he agreed with me, because I told him, if you come in here and you lie, and these were my exact words, I will nail you to the cross. And I meant that.
President Trump is due to meet the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in an hour for a second day of talks in the Vietnamese capital Hanoi. The summit, their second in less than a year, is expected to focus on removing nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula. The United States says it's focused on de-escalating the tension between India and Pakistan after the military confrontation between the two nuclear-armed neighbours. The statement came after Pakistan captured an Indian pilot after shooting down his fighter plane. It followed an airstrike by India against what it says was a militant camp in Pakistan. Rajini Vaidyanathan in Delhi says India's foreign ministry has responded.
They said that earlier today they summoned Pakistan's acting high commissioner to their offices in Delhi, where they lodged a strong protest at what they described as the unprovoked act of aggression by Pakistan. They have also demanded that the Indian pilot is released immediately. But most strikingly, perhaps in this statement tonight, was that it said India reserves the right to take firm and decisive action to protect its national security, sovereignty and territorial integrity against any act of aggression.
Venezuela's opposition leader Juan Guaido has announced he's travelling to Brazil after failing to return to Venezuelan territory from Colombia. He's expected to meet Brazil's right-wing leader Jair Bolsonaro on Thursday. Here's Leonardo Rocha.
Mr. Guaido was supposed to be back in Venezuela by now, but it appears he hasn't been able to return. He defied a Supreme Court travel ban when he arrived in Colombia on Saturday. From Colombia, he attempted to take tons of humanitarian aid across the border and was blocked by the Venezuelan army. President Nicolas Maduro says Mr. Guaido will face justice when he returns. If he's arrested, that may lead to a stronger response from the United States. But there's no support in Latin America for the deployment of foreign troops in Venezuela.
World news from the BBC.
Hello, welcome to Business Matters. I'm Ed Butler. On the programme today, shockwaves in Washington as Donald Trump's former lawyer calls his ex-boss a liar and a con man. And Pakistan and India face off over Kashmir. We hear why it's such a dangerous flashpoint.
This is the one issue that divides the two countries. And it's also an issue that probably will never be able to be resolved in any satisfactory manner.
More on this and much more from our guests today. Andy Shea, he's in Shanghai, an independent economist, formerly working for Morgan Stanley and the World Bank. Hello, Andy.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And in New York, Maya Van Rossum. She's the author of the book, The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment.
Hi, and good evening.
Good evening to you, where you are. Right, our first story today, a liar, a cheat and a con man. Those were the words of Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. He didn't mince them, did he, in testimony to Congress on Wednesday. Speaking before the House Oversight Committee, the man condemned to 3 years for lying to Congress himself gave what he asserted was a truthful assessment of his ex-boss and his own role in the president's rise to power.
Never in a million years did I imagine, when I accepted a job in 2007 to work for Donald Trump, that he would one day run for the presidency and actively win. I regret the day I said yes to Mr. Trump. I regret all the help and support I gave him along the way. I am ashamed of my own failings and publicly accepted responsibility for them by pleading guilty in the Southern District of New York. I am ashamed of my weakness and my misplaced loyalty, of the things I did for Mr. Trump to protect and promote him. I am ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience. I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
Dramatic stuff, and I got a sense of just how dramatic when I spoke to Daniel Lipman. He's a journalist with the online newspaper Politico. He was listening to the whole thing.
I think in terms of the metric of past landmark hearings on Capitol Hill, this ranks at near the top, because very rarely have, you know, or ever has a president, United States president's own lawyer, longtime fixer, totally flipped and gone against him and called him a liar, a racist, a cheat, a con man on national television in front of Congress. And so this kind of will go down in the history books as very unprecedented for someone who had the confidence of the president to totally abandon him and say that he is not a good person who led many people to lie for him and commit crimes.
Not a good person in, obviously, a range of different ways, according to Michael Cohen. Which were the allegations, the specific bits of testimony that stood out for you?
I think the one that stood out for me the most was Donald Trump's alleged reaction when told that WikiLeaks was going to release damaging emails that were hacked during the 2016 campaign. Roger Stone, who was also charged recently, he allegedly told Trump that this was going to happen, and Trump said, to the effect of that this is going to be great. So he had advanced knowledge of a crime of dissemination of these documents. And so that stood out for me. And also the fact that the payments, the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, continued even as President Trump had assumed that role. And, you know, they had an agreement with Michael Cohen to continue paying him to reimburse him because Cohen had originally paid off this. And so we did not know about that before, and we saw the checks as well.
Exactly. You say that. I mean, it was Stormy Daniels. This is the porn star actress with whom Donald Trump apparently had an affair, you know, in 2007. And this payment was made, and Michael Cohen produced this check, didn't he? I mean, he waved it around in front of the committee, apparently with Donald Trump's signature on it.
Yeah, and so that is a very indelible image, and people won't forget that. And it kind of confirms that Trump, you know, he didn't really think the rules applied to him. Cohen tried to be as contrite as possible in saying that, you know, I was wrong in being blindly loyal to someone that, you know, he had previously said he'd take a bullet for. And now he facing, you know, Cohen facing 3 years in jail that starts next month. He is apparently tired of lying as well. He had lied to Congress before, and so Republicans were quick to attack him on that and say to Democrats, you're bringing in someone who is not credible.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the Republican committee members might say, well, you know, he's in jail now. I guess he's not going to face charges a second time for lying to Congress. But you're right. You refer to that point. The Republicans will call to their base and say, look, it's extraordinary. We are, you know, we are speaking to a man who is returning to Congress only months, whatever it is, after the last time he came to Congress and spewed clear falsehoods, proven falsehoods to the same committee.
Yeah, and that's their argument. But we should remember that Cohen seems like a changed man now, and Republicans were not exactly defending Donald Trump during this testimony. And so there would be one thing if they said, well, you know, Trump actually didn't do that, or we think that he is correct in paying these women off or lying or what have you. All they did was attack his credibility. And so that indicates that they are not exactly rushing to defend Trump. It's more about shooting the messenger.
Daniel Lipman of Politico. Well, let's consider this a bit more with my guests, independent economist Andy Scheer in Shanghai and in New York via Maya Van Rossum. Maya, you're a lawyer. Much of what Michael Cohen said was perhaps predictable. Some of it he'd already said in court, hadn't he? Or it had been presented. Do you think this will legally resonate in the ongoing travails of the president?
I really don't know, because unfortunately the Republican Party seems to want to stand up for Donald Trump no matter what happens, right? They accuse Michael Cohen of being a liar and so somebody who should never be believed. And yet, on the other hand, Donald Trump himself is also a proven liar. And at every turn, the Republicans say we should believe him, despite the fact that his lies are proven. So because we have such a strong Republican Party that still has control of the Senate, my worry is that really this politically is not going to make a difference, and that's going to be devastating for this country.
Sure. Okay. So, yeah, Washington is definitely divided, but perhaps more immediately, what we do have is Michael Cohen, for example, waving a check saying this has got Donald Trump's signature on it, and it was paid to me in order to silence two women in the run-up to the 2016 election, something that has already been deemed an act of electoral finance fraud.
Yes, but we are also hearing, right, that the government is taking the position that a sitting president can't be charged. And so as long as that's the position, and then as long as Donald Trump is the president, it seems like he is not going to be able to be held legally accountable unless we have impeachment hearings. And of course, those will be stymied by the Republican Senate ultimately, right? So I think that it's very, very important that this information is coming out and that we are demonstrating the kind of person Donald Trump is, that he is a greedy, cruel liar that will, in fact, sell out everybody. But sadly, that does not mean, given the politics of the day, that does not mean that he's actually going to be held accountable, at least not in the near term.
Okay. Well, that is certainly one point of view. Andy Scheer in Hong Kong, I mean, the threat of impeachment, does that affect the way the president is seen? For example, in China, when in the midst kind of negotiations to wind down the tensions over tariffs and so on?
I don't think so. I think that the most people here in Asia assume Donald Trump will be reelected. So, you look at his support in the Republican Party is over 80%. American people know who he is. All the more details are not going to change people's mind. And the Democrats have not come up with a policy package to address the issue that why Donald Trump was elected in the first place. So that seems to be like more drama. It's just not going to change the reality. So we have to deal with Donald Trump probably for many years to come.
Well, more on Donald Trump, indeed, later in the programme. But for now, thanks to both of you. You're with Business Matters from the BBC World Service. A quick reminder now of the top headlines this hour with Julie Candler.
Donald Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen has said he fears there won't be a peaceful transfer of power if the president loses the 2020 election. Mr. Cohen, who's about to begin a 3-year jail term, said his loyalty to Mr. Trump had cost him everything and he couldn't sit back and allow the same thing to happen to the country. The acting US Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan has urged India and Pakistan to avoid further military action. The statement came after Pakistan captured an Indian pilot after shooting down his fighter plane. And President Trump is due to meet the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un shortly for a second day of talks in the Vietnamese capital Hanoi. The summit, their second in less than a year, is expected to focus on removing nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
Let's go straight to that summit described there in the news. It's aimed, of course, at de-escalating the military standoff over North Korea's nuclear program. Little to report so far, it seems, than the exchange of compliments. The BBC's Jonathan Head is in Hanoi watching for us. Jonathan, what did we see when the two men met? No, what are we expecting to see later today?
Well, the real talks start today. I mean, yesterday was essentially a resumption of the bromance, if you like. It was a dinner and a social get-together. There's 5 hours of talks today that start in just under an hour's time. And as far as we know, the Americans want what they call a big step from the North Koreans on dismantling their nuclear weapons program. In reality, as the two sides can't even agree on what denuclearization means, and the Americans, of course, want a complete dismantling of the weapons program, the North Koreans see it in the context of a broader peace in the region. I think what we're going to see is probably specific steps that they can describe as building on the relationship. Now, that could be North Korea agreeing to close a specific facility, possibly the Yongbyon nuclear facility that produces plutonium, which is significant. But of course, it would have to be verifiable too, in return for an easing of sanctions and then other measures, possibly like the opening of liaison offices in each other's countries, that kind of thing. These are going to be steps that will disappoint people who want a much more concrete framework for denuclearization. But the American side, and Mr. Trump will surely argue, as he has all along, that they're building confidence and that as long as the North Koreans aren't testing missiles, the world is a safer place.
A political statement to declare the 1950-53 Korean War over. That was something that was being talked about, I know, since some copy I read. I mean, is that a step too far? Would that be premature?
I think the Americans are uneasy about that because, of course, once that's done, then the North Koreans will then likely push hard for US troops to be taken out of South Korea. You know, each action they take has potential consequences for negotiations further down. You know, the North Koreans bargain very hard, and they're past masters at this. So that's the sort of detail that they'll be talking about in these 5 hours of chats. The detail that they'll know already what the proposals are on either side. Who can accept what and at what stage and what you get in return. And we won't know that until they sign their final declaration in about 5 hours' time.
Jonathan Head in Hanoi, thank you very much indeed. Let's turn to Andy Hsieh now in Shanghai. Tell us, what's the view from there about this? I mean, China, of course, has a lot riding, I suppose, on the success of this conversation.
Oh, I think that nobody in China or anywhere else in East Asia takes this very seriously. North Korea will not denuclearize, regardless of what they say, because that's the only way to safeguard the regime. It's about a survival. And so this is very much a Trump's show, and declaring the end of the war is... It sounds good, but you need to bring all the parties to the war, to the table, to negotiate a deal. And I don't see that that is coming anytime soon. So I think we still need to treat these like one of the Donald Trump's stunts. You know, this is really about the pageantry rather than about substance.
Right. So you're saying all the parties to the table. You mean the Chinese should be more actively involved because they're the only ones with real leverage over Pyongyang?
Yeah, but you know, when it comes to the negotiating table, both North Korea and China will ask the American troops to leave South Korea, which is, I don't see that the U.S. will talk about that. So you know, we cannot get the process started.
Maya, what do you think about when you see these talks carrying on?
I think here in the U.S., we're seeing it the same way as Andy and yourself and the previous speaker described it. It's really about the show. It's about the pageantry. Nobody really thinks that we're going to get something particularly meaningful, at least not for the U.S. There is tremendous concern when you listen to the Politico speak. There is actually tremendous concern that because Donald Trump is so ill-prepared that he will, in fact, be outmaneuvered by Kim Jong-un, and that he will give up something very serious and very significant. So while we all see it as it being about the pageantry, there is this concern, even by top-level officials, right, by everybody, that Donald Trump is going to somehow give away something very important because it's about the show for him.
Yeah, I mean, but maybe the flip side of this is the show is perhaps important because it matters to Kim. It matters to the North Koreans. They've been outliers. They've been outcasts in the international community for so long. At least someone is now taking them seriously, and that's part of the game.
part of the game, but also part of the problem, right? I mean, he has so many human rights violations and abuses, and we are now putting him center stage and have the president of the United States praising him, while at the same time, this very same president is denigrating other world leaders. So, you know, it may be part of the game, but it certainly is very troubling from where I'm sitting.
Andy?
Yeah, I think the what's important is Kim's attitude towards economic reforms. Going to Vietnam is maybe is important because Vietnam is booming, and Vietnam is under the communist dictatorship. So that's another model that he may be looking at. So if anything is coming out of this thing, it's really about the Vietnam model. Would North Korea follow that?
Okay, thank you for now. Let's move to our third story this hour. It is all about India and Pakistan. More drama there. India's demanded the release of a fighter pilot shot down by Pakistan warplanes in a major escalation between the two nuclear powers. The pilot was downed in a gunfight over Kashmir, of course. There are continuing angry words from India, although Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has called for dialogue between the two countries to ease the tensions. Madia Afzal is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institute think tank in Washington. I asked her for the background to this long-running conflict over Kashmir.
I mean, Kashmir has been an unresolved issue since 1947 for Pakistan and India. And it goes through ups and downs. You know, essentially, this is the one issue that divides the two countries and that sort of maintains the conflict between the two countries. And it's also an issue that probably will never be able to be resolved in any satisfactory manner. There's escalation and de-escalation on the issue depending on, you know, what's causing it. Since both Pakistan and India are nuclear powers, since 1971, you know, they haven't fought an actual war on the issue, which is in their interest and the world's interest. So usually after they reach sort of some kind of precipice that's at the brink of war, they're able to roll themselves back.
Yeah, I mean, from the Pakistani perspective, this is India controlling a largely Muslim population that is kind of secessionist minded, and therefore it's a kind of an occupying power. And obviously from the Indian perspective, the Pakistanis and the Pakistani military are being accused of constantly sending Islamists over the border or if you like, militants over the border to stir up trouble and attack Indian forces.
Yeah, absolutely. So because this conflict is not something that can be resolved via conventional war, you know, Pakistan's military being a lot weaker, even though it's a very strong military domestically, being a lot weaker than India's military. And because it's lost all its conventional wars, Pakistan has relied on a couple of things to sort of help it maintain some kind of parity with India. One is militant groups, non-state militant groups, and the other is its nuclear weapons. And so it's able to kind of maintain some sort of parity in this conflict because of those two things.
Okay, I mean, this is the first major international test, I guess, for Imran Khan, the new prime minister, or relatively new prime minister. How's he done? I mean, how did he appear as he spoke on TV today?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the domestic audience who's looking at him, they actually seem to be completely, you know, he seems to have united the country to be completely in line with the narrative, again, which was this is just a retaliatory strike for violation of Pakistan's sovereignty and calling for India to engage in talks and to de-escalate the war, talking about war being a miscalculation, always, you know, going into history and talking about World War I being a miscalculation and so on. So he struck a really conciliatory tone. Internationally, of course, where the world sees Pakistan as a bad actor in fostering or giving sanctuary to militant groups that then go on to attack India, the fact of the matter is that all of this began with an attack in Kashmir. Pakistan says that the attack in Kashmir was homegrown. India says that Pakistan-based militant groups were directly involved. And that's the problem. That's the narrative that Pakistan cannot command.
Meanwhile, there are those, of course, who will look at this whole situation and see perhaps the sinister hand of political opportunism in it, perhaps also on the part of Mr. Narendra Modi in India, who has elections in a couple of months.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is what Pakistan has been worried about. And Pakistan has constantly been saying that a lot of the warmongering in India and a lot of the calls for strikes against Pakistan and the calls for war have been due to these elections that are coming up and Modi needing to drum up the issue as much as he possibly can to garner support for himself. The question is, what will he do now after Pakistan's retaliatory strike? Will he be able to de-escalate, or will he feel the need to appear muscular again given that elections are coming up?
Madhya Afzal of the Brookings Institute. Andy Scheer, we've been talking about nuclear de-escalation in Korea. Two nuclear powers standing off against one another on the other side of Asia. Perhaps our focus has been in the wrong place.
Yeah, I think I always believed that North Korea is not important. It's an impoverished small country. And the conflict between Pakistan and India is more significant. Now, I don't think that both the two sides will go to a major war, but the risk of escalation is significant this time. India has lost face twice. As the previous guest said, there are elections are coming. So let's see how Modi handles the domestic pressure. But there's no winning situation for either party. You know, this conflict will be with us for a long, long time to come.
Yes, and of course, as mentioned, India has demanded the release of this fighter pilot. They seem to have been a certain loss of face. At least that is the expressions we're getting, I suppose, from the military in India this evening.
Yeah, I think Pakistan probably will release the pilot, but they probably will exact something in return, and that means that India stops talking about these terrorist thing activities in Kashmir.
Andy Scheer, thank you very much for that. We will return to you, and of course, my other guest Maya Van Rossum in the United States in the next half hour. More from Business Matters. Do stay with us. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Ed Butler. Now, to what extent should we have the legal right to repair the gadgets and machines that we own? Of course we should, many of you will say, although a lot of manufacturers disagree. EU ministers last month set out new measures to force manufacturers to make goods that last longer and that are easier to fix when they go kaput. The proposals refer just to lighting, televisions and large home appliances at the moment. They don't come into play for at least a couple of years, but at least 18 US states are also considering similar laws amidst a growing backlash against products which can't be prized apart because they're glued together or which don't have a supply of spare parts. Gay Gordon Byrne is executive director of something called the Repair Association in the US. She's taking on some big firms in search of her wished-for right of repair.
All of those little gadgets and devices that you buy, everything from an Alexa, you know, a listening device, to a Microsoft Surface Pro, which is unrepairable, these companies are producing things that can't be fixed unless they themselves fix them.
Why is this happening then? Do you think this has just been a steady creep of companies trying to basically close the shop on their own kit?
That is a very good explanation. If it had come out 10 years ago that you couldn't be able to repair your stuff the way we are today, I don't think anyone would have accepted it. The problem is we kind of crept at it. Incrementally, things have just stopped. We have two really big famous names that are kind of the poster child for this. One of them is Apple. And on the agricultural side, John Deere is certainly a major opponent. And they're doing the same thing to the farmers as Apple is doing to their consumers.
John Deere, the makers of tractors on the whole, right? So their tractors are not machines farmers can themselves repair or local mechanics.
Correct. Every now and then, these things are highly electronic. There'll be a software bug and something will happen and it'll say check engine. Well, the guy in the tractor can't just haul this thing over to the local mechanic and say, what is it? John Deere has to come to him. And if you're hundreds of miles away in the middle of a harvest, that's a huge delay, even if the guy just races out there. So it's terribly important that there be an immediacy of knowing how to manage the equipment. And then, of course, since John Deere is the only operation that can come out and make those determinations, they get to decide how much they're going to charge. So it can easily cost $1,500 just to find out that you need to reset the CPU.
$1,500 just to reset your computer.
Correct.
What do farmers do? I mean, in practice, what do they do?
Right now, they're adamant that they get their right to repair. The stalling point is that their organizations that represent them are not so good at advocating for this. So we get calls from all over the world now from farmers, but then we're not getting help from their trade associations. So it's a crisis on the farm, but it's not a crisis in the trade world.
Gay Gordon Byrne, I should say we did seek a response to all of this from John Deere, the agricultural machinery maker. No response actually was forthcoming, nor indeed did Apple or any other individual manufacturer want to speak to us about this. We did reach Susanna Baker, though. She represents Tech UK, which represents itself 900 technology and digital firms in Britain.
They have responsibility to make sure that a product is safe during its entire use. They also have to guarantee the data security and cybersecurity of that product.
But surely there will be ordinary people listening to this, and I think I include myself among them, saying, what's changed here? In the olden days, you had an electronics item, it went on the blink, you could go to somebody who would go and fix it for you. Now you have to either go through an approved dealer, and in some cases with some of these firms, they're charging you what seems like through the nose, when you could in the olden days get it done simply through anyone. There was a proper free market. What's changed?
Well, the products are more complex. The number of parts that are involved in the product is more complex, and the risk of fire is under particular scrutiny. We've got a whole range of new legislative structures in place designed to protect people from third-party operators who can't guarantee the safety of what they're providing to their customers.
So it's a safety issue in large measure, says Susanna Baker of Tech UK. Maya Van Rossum, one of our panellists today, you, from your position as an environmental advocate, I guess you will have a strong view on this.
Yes, I think that this is a very powerful movement because we see so much waste, whether you're talking about, you know, electronics or items large or small, because people are throwing things away because it's cheaper or easier to replace them rather than to go to all the time, the expense and the effort to get them repaired. So I think that this is a very powerful movement for reducing waste. And I just want to remind everybody, right, the environmental saying, it's reduce, reuse, recycle. And reduce and reuse are one and two. So this movement is a powerful way to bring those first two steps to life.
A lot, Andy Shea, a lot of the debate about this has been brought up, hasn't it, by some of the moves on the part of China and other countries to reduce the amount of technological waste that winds up with them and that they're supposed to dispose of.
Yeah, I think China, I think finally the government is cracking down, and they, all these electronics waste used to come to China, not anymore. So it's somebody else's problem now. But the second issue on this is that in the last 2 decades, we are observing this trend that it's a fine line between service and extortion. You know, the manufacturers, after they sell you something, they always ask you to bring it back, like an automobile and so forth. They ask you to pay. And the repair market in China is actually quite vibrant. A lot of parts, copycat parts are available. But if you fix it yourself, then next time you take it to, for example, Apple shop, they will not fix it for you anymore because they said you have tampered with the product. So I think this is something that the governments need to think about. Too much corporate power is not good for market or for the environment.
On the other hand, Maya, I mean, the counter argument that comes from those companies is they have copyright issues. They're worried. I mean, the likes of Apple are worried about if people can pick apart their stuff and if they're handing out kind of free tech books and indeed spare parts to all of their machinery, it's that much more easily copied and ripped off by cheap copies from places like Asia. What do you say? Is there no validity to those arguments in a world of increasingly complex tech?
Well, I think in a world where we have so much waste, in a world where we have so many environmental threats that are the result of over-manufacturing and planned obsolescence and this increased waste, I just don't think that those kinds of claims can win the day, right? We really do have to be thinking about the health and the safety of our farmers, as we've heard about, of people who are here on the earth today. But we also have to be thinking about protecting our resources for the people of tomorrow, and constantly throwing things away and taking away the ability to repair things easily and cost efficiently just does not serve either the present generations or future generations. It cannot win the day.
Now, let's find out some of the stories that are most engaging people in Asia today. Mariko Oi joins us. She's based in Singapore. Mariko, airlines operating flights from East Asia to destinations in Europe, they were all disrupted as a result of this upheaval, the shooting down of fighter planes, as we heard, over Kashmir.
That's right. We have seen some market reaction as well in both India and Pakistan. But also, as you mentioned, Ed, some airlines have been stopping some of the flights. In fact, Thai Airways has suspended all the flights that pass that conflict zones because of obviously the concerns of their safety. Of course, we have had some incidents in recent years of Malaysian Airlines carrier being shot down over Ukraine. So that memory is still vivid among some of the passengers and, of course, the airlines as well. So they're taking precautionary measures. But the analysts that we've been speaking to this morning say that while there are concerns about this conflict possibly even escalating, but many are thinking that they will probably try and calm the situation because neither country can really afford this economically from the financial point of view. Of course, Pakistan has just been receiving the IMF bailout, but of course, from Indian perspective as well, they can't really afford for this conflict to continue.
Now, we've been talking about the meeting between Kim Jong-un and President Trump in Hanoi. I suppose one thing we haven't talked about is how this is affecting the host nation, Vietnam.
Indeed, we've actually been looking into some of the cost versus benefit because, as we all know, it costs a lot of money. Last year, when Singapore hosted the first Trump-Kim summit, it cost the Singapore government some $15 million in total. Remember, Singapore paid for Kim Jong-un's flight and accommodation. We've been talking who's paying for this summit because it's highly unlikely that Vietnam did the same as Singapore. But in terms of the benefit, from exposure, all the media attention on the host nations, Singapore is estimated to have gained some $568 million. So that's not bad at all. You know, 38-fold return, if I calculated that correctly. So Vietnam's local businesses have been trying to make the most of it as well. We've been seeing some pictures of special stamps of Trump Kim Summit, but also Trump Kim cupcakes. So I've been nudging our colleagues in Hanoi, asking them to bring them back to Singapore next week.
Yeah, I wonder what do they taste like? Glad to hear that someone's cashing in anyway. Mariko Oi, thank you. Thank you for now. We must move on. If you're a woman in a paid job, are you one of those working long hours? Are you feeling stressed or even depressed? More so, perhaps, than the men around you. A study by University College London suggests that, well, you might just be that. Fighting against male dominance in the office and doing most of the housework at home are all contributing factors to the problem, according to Jill Weston. She's the author of the study, and she explained all to my colleague Vishala Sripatma.
What we found is that women who work long hours, and by that I mean more than 55 hours a week, tended to have a higher risk of depression than women who work standard hours, so 35 to 40 hours a week. But we didn't see the same for men. But both men and women who frequently work at weekends tend to have a high risk of depression.
Is it because of the type of work that women are more likely to do compared to men?
We think when it comes to long hours, women may be working in very male-dominated environments where they feel that they've got to put in even more effort than some of the men to get on. And then there's the additional time burden, if you like, if they then have to come home after a long day or long working week and still do all the household chores and the childcare and all those kind of things. So there are additional responsibilities and pressures that they may feel. And when it comes to weekend working, what we also suspect is that women who are working those patterns tend to be in low-paid, low-skilled jobs. And with that low skill and low pay tends to be matched with low rewards. So it's really a case of, is it really worth it? What's it doing to me? And often they don't have a choice.
What are the consequences?
When you're stressed, you tend to have a lower immune system. You tend to then get more colds, coughs. Then obviously there's, you know, anxiety, there's depression, there's a feeling of being completely overwhelmed, getting confused, until people get to the point of burnout. And at that point, they're just not going to show up for work anymore. I have seen studies where organisations have actually reduced the time that people are contracted to do and also continue to pay them the normal rate. And really interestingly, they haven't had a fall in productivity. They've actually had an increase. It shouldn't be about having marathon stints. It should be about short sprints so that you have time to recover and then focus, because actually our best decisions tends to be when we actually have breaks.
What can an individual do about this if they feel they're in a culture where people overwork and they feel obliged to do so?
It's much, much better if they go and have honest discussions with their managers. If they've got a trade union, then often they're a source of support and help. But even just going to talk to someone, whether it's a friend, whether it's an employee assistance type program where you can talk to a counsellor or a therapist, talking to others and actually beginning to discuss what are the real causes of the problems and what can be done about them. And taking a grown-up approach to it, because at the end of the day, as I've said, it's not good for the employer, it's not good for the employee.
If women are feeling more stressed than men, how do we address that imbalance?
Oh gosh, that is such a massive issue and I don't have all the solutions, but what I say is we need our politicians to talk, we need our trade unions to talk, we need our employers to talk and all the employers' organisations, and talk honestly with women. I know a fantastic piece of research has just been done by Professor Tarani Chan at the University of Manchester, where they looked at flexible working. Unfortunately, that wasn't the solution. Still 40% of women were still stressed. So we've got to think about what we can do to reduce the burdens, but in doing so, not to exclude women from working. But also, I think we need those grown-up conversations at home too. We still have a situation where men do not do as much housework and childcare as their partners do. We've got to treat each other as equals. And until that begins to happen, we're not going to see those changes within the workplace.
Jill Weston of the University of London speaking to Vishala a bit earlier. Strike a chord with you, Maya?
Yes, it absolutely does. I have the good fortune of working in a job that I absolutely love, and I definitely work more than 55 hours a week. And I have the good fortune of being married to a husband who actually does share very much in taking care of the kids and the house. And yet I do also see that I tend to feel like I'm bearing so much more of a burden than he does, that I'm always coming up short. And I think part of it for me anyway, and I think for others, is that you can never unplug. That when you work a long hours at a job, or when you have an important job that never seems to end, people can always get you by email, by cell phone, right? You're never allowed to turn off, even when you are supposed to be home taking care of the house and the kids and yourself. And so I think that really compounds all of the issues that we just heard about in this really important study.
Yeah, absolutely. And Andy Scheer, I mean, you know, setting aside the gender aspects to that story, there is a kind of cultural aspect was raised there, wasn't it? There are some parts of the world where just it's about work, work, work. And perhaps there isn't a forum for speaking about it when things get too much for employees.
Oh, yeah, I think that the pressure in East Asia is much greater than in Europe or in the United States. Virtually everyone works. And the women here work much longer hours than their counterparts in the West. And unfortunately, their grandparents look after their children here. But I think that the situation is not improving. And with globalization, certainly the pressure is everywhere. So I don't see how we're going to get out of this unless that the people shift away their focus on from economics to some sort of life and work balance. Right now, we don't see that.
How do you wind down? How do you wind down when things get too much for you, Andy?
For me, obviously, I have a coffee, have a beer. But I think that I'm fortunate because I can't do that. But for most people in China or in Japan, they don't have a lot of time. You know, they have late at night for Western companies in Shanghai. You go to the office, you see all the local people are still there.
Mm. Maya, what about you?
So when I want to try to decompress, I go for a hike, I go for a kayak, I go for a walk. The problem is, more times than not, I take that cell phone with me, right? And so I can get that phone call or am constantly looking at that email or getting that text message from work. So the only time I really disconnect, whatever it is I'm doing, is if I can manage to put that cell phone somewhere else and not take it with me. And then pretty much no matter what I'm doing, I can really take a breath.
Food for thought there, and a little bit more food coming up, actually, on a slightly different theme, which I want to bring to you now. UK secondary schools, in them, foreign language learning is now at its lowest level since the turn of the millennium. A BBC survey found that many thought languages were simply too difficult. I know what they mean. How useful is it to learn languages, though? The BBC's Luke Jones has been speaking to a couple of our very own BBC overseas and UK-based journalists.
Hello, hello.
Hey, Luke, how are you?
BBC Brussels man, Kevin Connolly. You can start with hello.
Well, hello, bonjour, marhaba, manishma, zdravstvuyte, dobry din, dzień dobry. I could go on.
Laura Koonsberg, you speak French.
I speak French. I speak French quite well. Bad Italian, even worse Spanish, very, very dodgy German.
What's it been like in Westminster today, en français?
Il fait très beau, il y a beaucoup d'histoire, mais on verra, on attend, monsieur le président, parce que Emmanuel Macron, Manu, pas Manu, et madame Merkel va parler de Brexit. That's really, 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 really shocking.
So, not to treat you like a jukebox, but could I request a bit of Polish?
Teraz niestety ja wszystko zapomniałem, Luke. At the moment, unfortunately, I can't call anything to mind. I've forgotten everything.
A lot of the schools who replied to this BBC survey said that the main reason for the drop in pupils taking it on was that it was perceived as a difficult subject. What do you make of that?
I think that's true, but I think, you know, difficulty is partly its own reward. If I'd had some sort of grounding in school, it wouldn't have been such a painful process. I'd have had a framework, a foundation dug that you could build the house of understanding on.
In my family, people kind of lived abroad and things, so it was quite usual to at least to be able to speak different languages.
There's the understanding of the direct conversation you're having with another person, and then beyond that, there's the understanding of the world around you, the advertising, the railway station announcement, the conversations taking place around you. And that roundness of understanding, that fullness of understanding, is a joy.
I suppose you could make the same argument about anything, couldn't you? Training your brain in any way, it shows willing and it shows sort of common cause, and it means you understand a bit more about the world.
And even if you feel like you're getting failing grades at school and it's not going so well, but the joy of it, if you stick with it, is something you'll only understand if you do stick with it.
From your near-perfect French to your middling German,
my
what can
bad,
you tell us?
My bad German. I can still say Schwarzwälder Kirschtorte, Black Forest Gatto, maybe useful a bit.
Maybe. That was BBC UK political editor Laura Koonsberg, alongside her, Kevin Connolly in Brussels, speaking to Luke Jones. Maya, I understand your dad spoke seven languages.
Yes, he did. My father was British, and so he learned some languages when he was young, and as a result, he built the capacity for learning languages. And he was a scientist, but he would lecture in other countries, and he always felt it was important to lecture in the language of the country where he was speaking. So I actually went through and wrote a list, and from what I recall, I was easily able to come up with seven of the languages I know he knew, including Tamil from India, right? So he had a broad repertoire. And he felt it taught respect or showed respect to the country. And he also really enjoyed it for himself.
Any of that rub off on you?
A little bit. My mum was Dutch, so we spoke some Dutch in the household, so I can speak a little bit of Dutch. And a lot of it was self-taught later after I unfortunately lost my parents.
Well, now that is interesting what you say there, because as it happens, my experience, I'm married to a Polish woman, and therefore I have kind of slightly bilingual children. I'll call them that because they did speak a bit when they were small, and they've kind of forgotten the Polish as they got older. But it does seem to have rubbed off on them in terms of their facility for learning new languages at school and beyond in later life. Do you find that? Do you find that just having been a little bit bilingual as a baby or as a young girl, maybe it
yes.
helps you later on?
Absolutely. I really do feel like I have a greater capacity to figure things out. And there's a lot sort of in the back of my brain. So every time I go to Holland to visit relatives, I'm amazed at how much I know. Right. So it's really in there. I think knowing how to or learning languages is very powerful and important. And I think it's awful to take that away from children because children are built to learn languages. Right. That's when they should be learning, when they're in school.
Andy Shea, tell me about your experience. I bet you speak loads of languages, don't you?
Well, I had to speak English because I went to the United States to study. So nobody at the time was talking to me in Chinese.
Yeah.
I think that the British kids are lucky in the sense that the kids in China or elsewhere in Asia are all learning to speak English. So the world is definitely moving towards English. If your native language is English, you're really lucky. But another topic is that the kids in the East, like China, Japan, or Korea, they study spend so much more time studying, probably twice as much time as the kids in the West. So that's another topic, you know, there yeah. will be serious implications.
But I mean, that thing about the languages and the British being lucky or the Americans being lucky because their language is the preeminent one, it's true up to a point, but perhaps it also makes those cultures a little complacent. I mean, you go to other parts of the world and everyone seems to have 3-4 languages. You go to parts of Africa and, you know, there are about 6 languages, well, in one corner of one country. So everybody is a polyglot.
Ed, I have to say, I agree with you totally.
Yeah, sorry. So Maya, you're agreeing with me that what we're all just become a bit kind of lazy when it comes to foreign languages in the Anglophone world.
Yeah, I don't think that the Anglophiles are lucky because, as you said, there's so much less incentive to learn another language, right? So I feel like we miss out.
Andy, sorry, I butted in on you.
Yeah, I think that the people elsewhere have to try harder. Maybe later on it will be beneficial to them. So this is where I see that English-speaking countries, they become a bit narrow-minded. So that's what reason we have been observing about the political trends and so forth.
So when you travel to a foreign country now, Andy, let's say it's not an English-speaking country, how much effort do you make to kind of be able to say, please, thank you, and can I have a coffee?
Well, very little. Usually I try to speak to people in English. Luckily I do get away with that. You know, even if you go to Japan, I speak a little bit of Japanese, but, it feels because so many English words are in Japanese language already. So it's not so hard to communicate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to hear. Listen, that's all we have time for. My thanks to both of my guests, Andy Shea. He's the independent economist, formerly worked for Morgan Stanley. He's in Shanghai. And Maya Van Rossum, author of The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment. This has been Business Matters. Thanks for listening.